Welcome to this WERU special program featuring a presentation from the 2011 Camden Conference, which was held February 18th to 20th, 2011. I'm Jim Campbell. The theme of the 2011 conference was The Challenges of Asia. In the first part of today's program, we'll hear a presentation by Hannah Beach, the Asia Bureau Chief for Time Magazine, on journalism in Asia. In the second part of the program, we'll hear excerpts from the final question and answer session of the conference, which featured responses by many of the conference presenters. The conference moderator was Mac DeFord, known locally for his weekly columns in the Free Press and his service on boards of local organizations, including the Camden Conference. Mr. DeFord was himself also a Foreign Service officer for over a decade. We'll go to him now, introducing Hannah Beach.
Let me introduce Hannah Beach, who gets this year's award for the furthest travel. She's just come in from Beijing, where she's the Southeast Asia Bureau Chief for Time Magazine. She's also a local in one sense, having graduated from Colby College a bare 15 years ago. And today she's going to tell us about how Asian journalists operate with state-controlled media.
Back in 2003, when a mysterious, deadly disease called SARS started appearing in Chinese hospitals, and just as quickly, information about it became censored from local newspapers, I got a call from the State Security Bureau in Shanghai. Calls from the State Security Bureau, which is quite a secretive organization that reports directly to the Chinese cabinet, the State Council, never bode well. I'd gone through several interrogation and what are called self-criticism sessions with the Public Security Bureau and with the Foreign Ministry, which were bad enough. One time I actually had the Foreign Ministry bring in a journalism professor to lecture me on journalistic ethics because they discovered that I hadn't gone to journalism school and clearly I needed a refresher course. This time I sensed, though, that I was in deeper trouble. SARS had not only spread rapidly through China, killing hundreds and hospitalizing thousands. It was also embarrassing a government that was intent on keeping the true death toll quiet, lest it hurt the flow of foreign investment. When I got the call from the State Security Bureau, I gulped and agreed to a meeting. The State Security Bureau official wanted to meet at a Starbucks. I guess that should have been my first sign that this was not going to be a normal meeting. Normal meetings, as those of you who've been to China will know, usually happen in various grandiose ministries, and you sit in one of these kinds of chairs, oversized with antimacassars on the side, and you have to sort of lean your head over and talk to the person who's given you a lecture or criticizing you or whatever reporting you've done. So back to my State Security meeting. The agent, we're sitting outside in Xintiandi, which is a ritzy part of Shanghai, and he orders a mocha. I got a latte. He began with the usual litany. I'd broken the law by doing some of my SARS reporting outside of Shanghai where I was accredited. And this was true. At the time, the foreign ministry regulations were such that if you were based in, say, Shanghai or Beijing, every time that you did reporting outside of Shanghai or Beijing, you had to get permission from the foreign ministry. Now, in point of fact, you almost never did that because either you didn't get the permission. The foreign ministry would say, oh, maybe next week, next week, next week, and if you're a journalist, next week is not good enough. Or they would assign you a minder whose job was essentially to impede any reporting that you hoped to do. Anyway, I told the state security guy that I was sorry. I blamed my editors, which is always a useful trick. Sometimes the officials who deliver such lectures get really into it, and it usually concludes with some variation of, you're an American agent trying to make China look bad to the rest of the world. This guy was somewhat half-hearted in his criticism, and he finished, and he took a sip of his mocha, and he said, can we talk off the record? I was surprised, but said, sure. He wanted to know how bad SARS really was. His daughter was in elementary school, and despite the government's claims that the SARS epidemic was not serious, he was scared. What symptoms should he look out for? He'd heard from a local journalist friend, who of course wasn't allowed to report, sorry, this is a little bit of self-promotion. He'd heard from a local journalist friend who wasn't allowed to report on what he actually knew, that what Time magazine had first reported was true. SARS patients, particularly in Beijing, were being loaded into vans and being driven around the city while visiting health inspectors came so that their existence was hidden from the health officials. Did I, the person to whom he just delivered this criticism session, really know what was going on? Off the record, of course. I bring up this story for two reasons. One, it's easy to talk about the faceless Communist Party of China, but here is one face who is simply a father concerned about his daughter's welfare. The second is that as well-connected as he was depending on information from a local journalist to know what was going on. This is a country where the government still dictates much of what is published in newspapers. Here's the front page from the China Daily on the day that Liu Xiaobo was awarded the Nobel Peace Prize last year. The Chinese government, as you may know, tried to pressure governments around the world from not attending the Peace Prize ceremony in Oslo in December. In the end, I think fewer than 20 countries, which included a rogues gallery of countries like Iran and North Korea, boycotted the ceremony. But according to the China Daily, that is, quote, most nations. And I love the fact that award cannot change fact. He is a criminal. Other information is still very censored. The government's propaganda department sends out a directive every day to various media and websites telling them what can and cannot be reported. Sometimes these go on for pages. For instance, take the following directive issued on January 28th. Quote, for the disturbances in Egypt, media across the nation must use copies circulated from Xinhua, which is the official state news agency. Websites are to strengthen monitoring of posts, forums, and blogs. Our bureaus will forcibly shut down websites that are lax in monitoring, end quote. That one sort of makes sense given the political sensitivities, but the directives can reach almost comic proportions. Here's one from just before Chinese New Year, which is also called Spring Festival in China. Quote, all news units must organize reporters during the Spring Festival to go deep into the lower social strata for interviews, working to create a holiday atmosphere of celebration and ardent happiness, end quote. And just one more, this is from January, quote, for the merger of Shandong Finance College and Shandong Economics College, there have been no authoritative announcements from related bureaus. Malicious hype is not permitted, end quote. Look, China is still a country with 34 journalists in jail last year for doing their job, according to the Committee to Protect Journalists. Nevertheless, the local press has an incredibly vital role to play, and its power is only increasing. China, like the rest of Asia, is a world apart from the US and Europe. Here, I'm told that my industry is practically in its death throes. Young Americans rarely read a newspaper or a magazine in its print form. In Asia, newspaper subscriptions are actually increasing. New publications are starting up all the time. In Burma, newsstands have gone from carrying a couple dour government newspapers to today when there are more than 100 weekly newspapers, 20 of which cover news. In Japan, the average person subscribes to 2 daily newspapers. In Asian countries that are ruled by restrictive regimes, journalists are often forced to play a cat and mouse game. If they get caught, they can end up in jail or even killed. In the Philippines, for instance, in 2009, 33 journalists were killed for doing their jobs. But they do their work with skill and bravery. In China, there are a few ground rules. For instance, if you're based in southern China, don't report on scandals in southern China. Better to investigate malfeasance up north. If you happen on something on your home turf, call a friend in another part of the country and he'll get the news out. That gives you a bit of protection if the local chieftains are worried about protecting their fiefdoms. The free market has also changed the way that the media operates, particularly in China. It used to be that Chinese newspapers were subsidized by the government, which meant that they didn't have to worry about making money. And they could print front page headlines like China-Gambia relations at an all-time high. But a few years ago, the media industry changed. Newspapers were supposed to make money. So the publishers and editors suddenly started caring about what their readers might want to read about in order to sell their publications. Sure, there are still topics that no newspaper or magazine or TV station will touch without a central government directive. For instance, anything to do with central government corruption or anything to do with Tibet or Taiwan or the northwestern province of, or autonomous region rather, of Xinjiang. But within bounds, muckraking is now allowed in China. I think part of this is because the central government sees the value in letting Chinese citizens let off a little bit of steam. This is, after all, a country that last year, by the government's own numbers, which are probably too low, had 100,000 public protests. If people felt that none of their needs were being addressed, then the anger at the government might explode. But by allowing the press to report about occasional illegal land grabs by local officials or pollution by companies, Beijing hopes to maintain the illusion that there is accountability in the new China. The internet has also expanded the power of local journalists. I don't think anyone's expecting an Egypt-style revolution to unfurl in China online. For one thing, Facebook and Twitter are banned in China. Although, of course, there are ways to get around what's called the Great Firewall. Nevertheless, information zips around the internet in China in a way that is amazingly fast. Chinese journalists who are told that they can't report on a certain story may bypass the traditional media completely by blogging about it or using China's domestic version of Twitter. One link is picked up by another person, which is picked up by another person, and suddenly more people know what's going on online than those that read the People's Daily, which is the government's official mouthpiece and claims to have the world's largest readership. Yes, government censors can and do extinguish these little wildfires online, but as soon as they stop one, another will take its place. In some cases, stories that went viral in the blogosphere couldn't be ignored by the government anymore, and they ended up in the traditional media. For instance, there were reports in 2008, around the time and after the Olympics, that infant formula had been tainted with melamine, and hundreds of babies were killed, hundreds of thousands of babies were sickened. Eventually, after weeks of silence, the government-controlled media was briefly allowed to report on the news. Unfortunately, the free flow of information didn't last long. Censors kicked in again, and one activist who helped parents who were petitioning about their children was sentenced to prison last year. The problem with this online system, though, is that there is an almost total lack of accountability. Rumor and fact are rarely differentiated. Even worse, journalists in China are paid so poorly that they regularly take in what are called chima fei, which translates to car horse fee. These fees are supposed to cover, say, the transportation costs to a press conference. In fact, they are bribes from local officials or local companies for positive coverage. Car horse fees can easily equal or surpass a reporter's monthly salary. Western journalists will sniff and say, oh, that's just PR masquerading as journalism, and they're right to a certain extent. But I think there's also a fundamental difference in the way that East Asians perceive the role of journalism from that of the West. Here in the States, the media ideal, I'm not sure how often we live up to it, but at least the ideal is that of a vital check and balance against the ruling elites. Thomas Jefferson said, quote, "If I had to choose between government without newspapers and newspapers without government, I wouldn't hesitate to choose the latter," end quote. In East Asia, even in democracies like Japan, the assumption, I think, is a little bit different. Journalists aren't supposed to uncover scandal so much as act as a voice of moral authority. That doesn't mean that they're government mouthpieces exactly. I think that's too simplistic a reading. But in general, the media's role is to reflect the prevailing mood or tell people what's right. Thailand is technically a democracy, and its press should be free to report on what's going on. But there is a cone of silence when it comes to the country's monarchy. This is King Bhumibol Adulyadet, who is the longest-serving monarch in the world. If you look at even foreign media stories about the Thai king, you will invariably see one of these phrases, quote, beloved monarch, or, quote, the king who is adored by his subjects. Is he? Probably. But the Thai press and the foreign press are both restricted by lèse majesté laws not to bring up the issue at all. Lèse majesté can land someone in jail for up to 15 years. An electronics law that was passed a few years ago takes the jail time to an even higher level, with each instance of defaming the king earning somebody up to a decade in jail. Right now, there's a woman named Chiranuk Premchapon, who's the web manager of one of Thailand's most respected online news sites. Her alleged crime? For not deleting anonymous comments posted on her website that were critical of the royal family quickly enough. Conceivably, she could end up with 80 years in jail. I think of my Asian journalist colleagues, and I'm amazed at their commitment to their jobs, to the necessity of telling the truth, despite such obstacles. I have a friend in Burma who is a newspaper editor. Burma is really one of the worst places in the world to be a journalist. Foreign journalists are essentially banned from reporting there. When I go there, I masquerade as an art dealer. And whenever I return with my requisite plastic bags filled with Burmese lacquerware, I'm sure that it's going to be the last time. The locals, of course, have it much harder. My only threat is deportation, but at least a dozen Burmese reporters were in prison in 2010, and three more were sentenced earlier this year. The official newspapers are required to carry this on their back pages every day. I mean, Orwell could not make this up. I particularly love the VOA, BBC, sowing hatred among the people. And this is, you know, every single day, this is the back page of Burmese newspapers. Anarchy begets anarchy, not democracy. Riots beget riots, not democracy. Sort of a logical fallacy. Whenever I visit my Burmese journalist friend on deadline day, he'll show me two drafts of his newspaper. One is the one that he submits to the censorship board, and the other is the one that's covered in red ink that he receives back from the censorship board asking for information to be excised or for things to be changed. When Aung San Suu Kyi, the Nobel Peace Prize laureate, was released last year from 7.5 years of house arrest, he published a supplement on her release, and this was technically allowed. Of course, you had to have very carefully worded articles. But because he made the size of the supplement the same size as his newspaper, his publication was banned for a week. And because he submitted his draft to the censors a few hours late, and this was because Suu Kyi was released in the evening and the time lag was difficult to handle, he was threatened with 7 years in jail, and he had to officially resign from his post as editor of the newspaper. In point of fact, he still does his job. His name just isn't on the masthead. There are some victories, though, and this one is one of my favorites. It's from a sports newspaper called First 11, which, given its athletic focus, wasn't supposed to cover Suu Kyi's release at all. That night, the First 11 editors submitted their front page headlines to the censors, but in black and white. The censors said fine. When the headlines appear the next day, you'll notice that there's some slightly selective shading. And I don't know if you can make it out, but it reads, if you look at the light red, it says, Sue, free, period. Unite and advance to grab the hope. So it's one of the few times that the Premier League has been connected to politics. In conclusion, I'll tell you another story about the changing role of media in Asia. Last year, I moved back to Beijing after nearly a 10-year absence. In 2001, I'd almost gotten kicked out of China for reporting on two stories, one on the rural AIDS epidemic, and this is actually some villagers that I interviewed who really didn't know what they were dying of in China at the time. They had been selling blood, and they knew that they were dying of a disease that they called guaibing, or strange disease, or wuming-bing, which means no-name disease. But they didn't understand the ramifications of HIV and AIDS. And the other story that I'd done was on baby selling in southwestern China. When the International Olympic delegation came to Beijing for the last time before deciding whether or not to award Beijing the 2008 Olympics, which of course they eventually did, a press flack at the IOC had put together a binder of press clips about China, and my two articles, the one on AIDS and the one on baby selling, were in the folder. China desperately wanted the Olympics, and the foreign ministry was not amused that my articles were in it, and in this folder. So I was called in for my zuo peeping, my self-criticism session. And it took a few uncomfortable hours, and I smiled and sat there in my chair. And the man who delivered my lecture spoke very good English, and he was quite proud of it. And he said, look, I'm going to tell you a metaphor that as an American you should understand. Three strikes and you're out. He told me that I already had two strikes, the two stories that had been in the IOC folder, and he thought that it would be wise of me to try to avoid my third strike. As a digression, this was the same IOC trip where, in the middle of winter, the grass in the diplomatic compound where I lived was dyed bright green just because the IOC delegation was on a highway that zipped very briefly past it, and they thought that it would look nicer if the grass was green in January. I was wearing white shoes, and I was not happy that they turned green. So fast forward 10 years, and I'm back in Beijing. I get a call on my mobile phone, and this is a number, by the way, that I'd just gotten. I'd barely given it to my editors, much less friends and family. It was a Chinese man. He gave his name in a big title at Phoenix TV in Hong Kong. Phoenix is an interesting story. It's run by a former People's Liberation Army soldier who invested very wisely in the crazy economic reform days of the 80s. Eventually, he decamped to Hong Kong, from where he decided to build a media empire. Today, Phoenix is probably the best TV news source in Mandarin. It toes the line, certainly, but it also breaks news. For instance, during 9/11, local Chinese channels were blacked out the news for hours, and it turned out it was because the propaganda minister had been on vacation and nobody was quite brave enough to take the responsibility of allowing the live coverage of the Twin Towers. Anyway, Phoenix was the only channel in Mandarin that was broadcasting early live coverage of the terrorist strike. Phoenix still needs to be allowed on Chinese airwaves, and so it avoids news that it knows will get it in trouble, but it won't allow itself to be a mouthpiece for the Chinese government either. So, for instance, this is their newsroom in Hong Kong. So, for instance, the news that Liu Xiaobo won the Nobel Peace Prize, never mentioned on Phoenix TV. However, when other publications and TV stations or networks were forced to run those crude attacks on Liu Xiaobo, like the one I showed from the China Daily, Phoenix didn't do that either. This man, whom I shall call Mr. Phoenix, asked me if I remembered him. I said, I'm sure, of course I remember you. I didn't, of course, because I didn't remember having met any Phoenix bigwig. And he said, would you like to come to lunch? And it wasn't so much a request as a command, and I said, yes, I'd love to go out to lunch. So for about the first 20 minutes, I recognized the guy, but I couldn't quite place him. And he was very pleasant, and he was gossiping quite knowledgeably about the Beijing leadership. I still had a gut feeling about him that was not good. And then suddenly I remembered, this was the guy who'd given me my three strikes and you're out speech. I'd never gotten my third strike. And shortly after he chewed me out, Mr. Phoenix had resigned from the foreign ministry. He said it took more than 2 years to get permission to move to Hong Kong to do his job at Phoenix. Is this guy a spy? Maybe. But he also knows a lot of inside baseball, if I can take his metaphor further. He didn't quite go as far as apologizing for his three strikes lecture, but he did complain a lot about how Phoenix journalists in recent years had been jailed or arrested for doing their job. He was appalled that the foreign ministry would call him up and accuse him of making China look bad to the rest of the world. He seemed utterly confused about this censorship machine, something that he was part of just a decade ago. Did he understand the irony? I don't know. But this kind of role reversal happens all the time in the New Asia and the New China. It's fun to keep covering it. Thank you very much.
We've got time for three or four questions.
Hi, my name is Ariadne Dimoulas. I'm from the University of Maine in Orono. And I have a question. You briefly mentioned baby trafficking, and I know you probably can't go into it, but is that something you are at liberty to discuss? I would just like to know if it's
I'm absolutely at liberty to discuss it. It happened a while ago, so I'm not sure if I remember all the details, but several of the speakers have talked about the gender imbalance in China. And one of the strange things that has happened is that children, babies, particularly from the underdeveloped provinces in the southwest, are being trafficked to the eastern, most prosperous provinces, and they're usually boys because families want boys. And so there was a huge trade. I was actually trying to see whether there was any link between baby trafficking and overseas adoptions, because of course there's so many Chinese babies who are adopted, particularly in the U.S. And I wasn't able to find that link, although I suspect it does occur. But this is more about babies who were being trafficked from southwestern China to eastern China. And the reason that it also happens is, again, something that other speakers have alluded to, which is the one-child policy. And so family planning officials, if somebody got pregnant again, will say, look, you can have the baby, but we're going to take the baby from you and give it to a family somewhere else. And the family planning officials, who are corrupt, got a good cut of the proceeds.
John Karen from Greenwich. Do you see any possibilities in the future of a free press in China?
I think the evolution of the press in a very short time has been impressive. I mean, we've gone from very censored newspapers to an explosion of information. I think the real change will happen not so much in the traditional print form of publications, but on the internet. And you're already seeing, as I mentioned, the incredible explosion of information on the internet.
And another one down here.
Rebecca Highland from Phillips Exeter Academy. I was wondering, since many speakers mentioned yesterday that we should be thinking about cooperating with China in the future, especially with energy resources, I was wondering, as a journalist, to what extent do you think that's possible to cooperate if we have such different ideas about free speech in the press?
One of my jobs, and again, this isn't an ideal form, one of my jobs is to try to explain China to the U.S. and explain it in a way that it is not a scary communist country. It's filled with people like us. And of course, there may be different perspectives and different philosophies, but these are two big countries that have far more similarities than differences. And I think the more information that is out about what is happening in China, the better it is for global relations. Now, the difficulty, if you look at the American media and the European media, is that the number of foreign correspondents based in China and the rest of the world is shrinking rapidly. And so just at a time where what happens in China matters so much more for all of us, the information that's coming out from foreign correspondents is winnowing down, and that's a really big problem.
Meg Tuohy from Salem, Massachusetts. I wanted to ask, given the shrinkage of journalists from around the world, who in both Europe and the U.S. do you think is providing good coverage that we should be watching or reading?
Yeah, I mean, there are certain big American media organizations, the New York Times, the Wall Street Journal, that provide very good comprehensive coverage. The difficulty is that the smaller regional newspapers, the Baltimore Sun, the Chicago Tribune, which are venerable organizations that used to have great foreign correspondents, they don't have those resources anymore overseas. And so if you have a great New York Times correspondent, and the crew right now is very strong, then you're okay. But maybe the next iteration, the people won't be as strong, and then how do you get the best coverage out?
And just to add to the answer, I would also say Time Magazine. Judith?
Hello, I'm Judith Daniels from Union. Speaking of Time Magazine, I was wondering how they protect their journalists today. I mean, they've always had bureaus sending people into very difficult countries, but you were living there. I assume as an American you have some protections, but I wonder what companies do now.
In general, war zones obviously are a different matter, and even in Thailand, where I lived for 4.5 years before I just moved back to Beijing, you know, they were battles on the streets, and friends who were journalists were killed on the streets. But accepting those situations, which are somewhat extraordinary, really the worst thing that can happen to me is to get deported, and that's not pleasant because I have a family and we would have to move and all that. But I think that the real question is what happens to the people to whom I speak and who are willing and courageous enough to share information with me, because they're not going to just get deported. They're going to get jailed. They can get killed. I mean, I've had, you know, you and I have talked about this. I've had people, sources that I've talked to who've ended up in jail. There was a story in the New York Times yesterday about a blind legal activist who's been in and out of house arrest and jail for the past 6 years, 7 years. And he got arrested about 2 hours after he and I spoke. You know, and there is an incredible amount of guilt associated with that. And you have to, and for somebody like him, I think he knew the risks of what he was doing. But if you're interviewing a farmer in a village in the middle of nowhere about the problems with the one-child policy or about local corruption, they can't understand the ramifications of their story appearing in Time magazine. And so you have to protect them to a certain extent. You may not use their full name, or you'll say, you know, a farmer from something-something village. But to go back to your question, you know, Time does have, there are these courses in which you learn, you know, outgoing fire and incoming fire and this and that. And so you can go and learn what to do when a grenade drops in your truck. And we've had our journalists, bureau researchers in Baghdad who've been killed. We've had a photographers on contract for Time who has shrapnel in his body. We've had a Washington correspondent for Time who was in Baghdad whose arm was blown off. I mean, it can be a dangerous position, but we put ourselves in that position, so we can't be overwhelmingly surprised if something happens.
Karen Carberry from the University of Maine. I think that there are some leaders who are much more savvy when it comes to the media than others. Putin.
Sorry, about which media?
Who are more savvy when it comes to the media than other leaders.
Yeah.
Putin, Tony Blair, Barack Obama. In your opinion, is there anyone in the Middle East, or I'm sorry, in Asia, particularly in China, who is savvy enough to actually embrace and utilize the media for political purposes other than just putting out censorship and propaganda? Are anyone poised to do that in the future?
I mean, the difficulty with living and covering China is that, in general, I can't talk to the senior leaders. They don't, if they give press conferences, they're not going to take a question from me. They're going to take a question from a plant from the Chinese media. So we end up doing a lot of political tea leaf reading based on little snippets of information. Now, I have good sources at think tanks and foreign ministry officials who will tell me things off the record. But I will say that there are a couple sort of up-and-coming Communist Party leaders who do engage with the media. There was a former Shanghai mayor named Xu Guangdi who was very savvy and was very open. Now I'm blanking on his name, the party secretary in Chongqing, whose father was a famous PLA. You know the name. Bo Xilai, thank you. You know, Bo Xilai will meet with the foreign media, and he has a very good reputation as a result. I mean, the irony is that by closing themselves behind the bamboo curtain, they're making themselves more sort of inscrutable and oriental. And if they would just come out and talk to us, they would become like Bo Xilai, who is suddenly being trumpeted as sort of the future of economic reform in China. I don't know whether that's true, but he's gained that reputation because of it, and he's smart enough to understand that.
We've got time for two more, one in the balcony and then Jeff. Yeah.
Nate Kinney from the University of Maine. I was just wondering if you could talk about the behavior of the Asian youth towards media. And I know that you mentioned the newspaper publications have grown, whereas here in the United States they've started to shrink. And just kind of, is there a desire over there to stay globally connected in the world? Whereas from my perspective, I see that less and less students and people of my generation who are becoming less connected with the world. Maybe are just listening to a 30-minute segment of Glenn Beck instead.
Yeah, no, I mean it's a very good question. I think there are two things happening at the same time. I think one, young people like everywhere in the world are the most tech savvy, and so they have the potential to be able to go online and find out lots of information. The truth, though, is that a lot of young people go online to play video games or look at porn or do what it is that everybody else does in the rest of the world when they go on the internet. So you have the potential for it, and I think you do see in certain segments people who are committed to using the internet to be able to find out information. But from those people who hope that democracy would suddenly appear because of the internet, I don't think that's been followed through. The other thing, if I could quickly mention, is young Chinese people today, I would say, and this is a huge generalization, but I would say that they are generally less political than almost any other youth cohort in the world. And I think that's partly because of the social contract that many people have talked about, which is, you know, you get rich and don't worry about the politics side. Now, the difficulty will come, as it's starting to already. In July 2010, about 25% of Chinese graduates from college hadn't found jobs. You know, that's a huge percentage. And if that is the case, if they still cannot find jobs, if economic growth is not sustained, this is a group of people who are products of the one-child policy. They're spoiled. They've had everything given to them. Life has only gotten better. And all of a sudden, things aren't going their way. And, you know, the question is whether that will galvanize action. I don't know the answer to it, but it's an interesting one, particularly looking at what's been happening in the Arab world.
One last one, Jack.
I'm Dick Sweat from Dover Foxcroft. My question is, do most native Chinese journalists share your frustration at government censorship, or do they feel that the government's idea that this is what is best for the country is truly best for the country?
It's interesting. I think that there's been a generational change within the Chinese journalist community. I think 15 years ago, somebody who was a Chinese journalist was tended to be kind of a loyal Communist Party guy, usually guys, who did the job because it was easy and because you just got handed a copy and you typed it up and that was your day job. I think now you're finding a whole cohort of younger journalists who are actually interested in real journalism. And I think, yes, they absolutely share the frustrations. Luckily, they have some sort of outlet with the internet. They can also, you know, a lot of the stories that I've supposedly broken, I haven't broken. My friends who are local journalists have broken, and they've given the information to me. So they are very generous in terms of sharing information.
Terrific. Thanks an awful lot.
We just heard a presentation from the 2011 Camden Conference on your community radio station, WERU-FM. The presenter was Hannah Beach, Asia Bureau Chief for Time Magazine. In the remainder of the program, we'll hear selections from the final session of the conference, which featured a question and answer session in which most of the conference's presenters participated. The respondent voices we'll hear, in order, are those of Moderator Mac DeFord, Ambassador Chaz Freeman, David Gordon, Hannah Beach, and finally, Lan Xingsheng.
Robert Azzi from Exeter, New Hampshire. Ambassador Freeman made reference to the movement of petrochemicals, Arabic students, etc., from the Persian Gulf flowing eastward towards India and China. We know from experience where Saudi oil flows, so do Salafis and Wahhabis. Given that most of Chinese development is in the East and most Muslims are in the West of that country, contiguous to India, Pakistan, et cetera, my question is, what do you think is the possibility of non-state actors, separatist groups, et cetera, rising and causing individual hotspots, not unlike Kashmir or Chechnya, which would cause Chinese and India governments to have to directly intervene and divert resources in order to control them?
Now, not everybody on the panel has to answer, but whoever, Chaz, why don't you begin? And if you don't feel like answering a particular question, don't bother. We move on.
Well, I also referred, I think, to historic ties between the Islamic West and the East. Somebody mentioned Admiral Zheng He, the great Ming Dynasty admiral who visited the Indian Ocean Basin and toured it multiple times. What you may not know, well, he was a eunuch. Now, before you snicker at that, you should realize that lots of places, before Washington, D.C. even, have done very well at running empires through eunuchs. Byzantine Empire, you know, the Ottomans, and even the Chinese. Anyway, point is, you may not also know that Admiral Zheng's father was a Haji. He had been to Mecca on pilgrimage. He was a Muslim. He spoke Arabic. It was not a voyage of discovery so much as a voyage of reconnection that he made. There are no clear and concise and accurate estimates of the number of Muslims in China. The official estimate is somewhere a little over 20 million. That's registered people. The actual number is thought to be about 130 million. Beijing, historically, was one-third Muslim, which is why many of the restaurants are halal, meaning kosher. Same word, same concept, exactly the same, with very few minor differences. And China, of course, does contain a number of regions where the majority is Muslim. These include ethnic minority regions like Xinjiang. They also include Hui, Chinese Muslim regions like Ningxia, which is a province in the northwest. So there are all these connections, and there are regular Hajj flights now from places like Kashgar to Mecca through Jeddah. And there is, in fact, a huge reconnection going on. And I can tell you that the Chinese, just as they are very vigilant to Internet-sponsored unrest, as you can see if you read today's news, are very vigilant in response to the possibility of Islamic extremism coming into their country. The formation of the Shanghai Cooperation Organization was in no small measure motivated by a desire to keep that under control. So it's an issue. Religious extremism, fundamentalism, religious maniacs of various sorts seems to be proliferating in every religion everywhere, and the Chinese do not want this to happen in China. So they will keep the screws on.
Dave.
Yeah, a couple of comments. I completely agree with Chaz that Wahhabism is not going to be allowed inside China to take root. On the other hand, China as a target for Islamic extremists and terrorists because of growing energy relations, that's not at all impossible to conceive. In fact, I think it's likely that we're going to see some of this in coming years as China plays a larger role. China tends to be surprised when there's pushback against them in parts of the world that they go into. So when there's pushback in Zambia, when their oil programs get renegotiated more or less unilaterally in Angola, when there are some demonstrations in other parts of Africa that takes them by surprise, because their view is that they're just a power going out and not making demands on other people, and they just expect to be allowed to do this. But I think that it's not at all unlikely that as China's role in the world rises, particularly if you still have this phenomenon of Islamic extremism against their place in the world, that the target set could begin to shift from Western countries like the United States and Western Europe to rising powers, including China.
Just to add two small things to that, I think
it's not in the Chinese press, but there have been Chinese oil workers who have been kidnapped in Sudan and Somalia and Nigeria, and what you talked about is already becoming an issue. The second is in terms of Xinjiang, and I think if you look at the Russian model of Chechnya and say this is a way not to deal with an Islamic region, you could argue the same thing with China and Xinjiang. China has a problem not only with the potential of importing of Wahhabism, but radicalizing the local population because of repressive policies.
Good morning. My name is Catherine King. I'm a school teacher at Hampden Academy. I heard Ambassador Pickering assert that the United States, if I understood him correctly, that the United States is the only country who can move the Arab-Israeli peace process forward to a solution. My question is, do we, given the apparent decline in our credibility internationally, do we functionally have the ability anymore to move that peace process to a resolution? And even if we do, assuming that we do, given the negativity and irritation that our intervention in foreign affairs apparently generates, is that something that we should burden share, I guess, if that's a verb, with other countries in the world?
Yeah. He certainly did say that he thought we are the ones that can solve it if it can be solved. Why don't we start with Chaz and see if anybody else wants this?
I think both I and Tom Pickering said, and I certainly agree with him, the United States is the only country as such that can both move the parties toward peace in the Middle East, or for that matter, block movement toward peace, as I fear we have done more than once in the past recent period. But I don't think, despite the grave damage we've done to our own reputation and influence internationally, that the block to effective American diplomacy in the Middle East is international. I think it's domestic. It's our own paralysis, schizophrenia, and inability to muster the will to act to help establish Israel as an integral, respected, and accepted part of the Middle East that blocks us, not the international community. Were we to do what Tom suggested, which is to outline a final status for the Palestinians and a resolution of the Israeli disputes with the Palestinians and other Arab neighbors, I can assure you there would be a huge standing ovation internationally. People would like the United States to lead rather than veto and obstruct.
Other comments?
So I think the challenge here is that in the aftermath of these events in the Middle East, Tunisia, Egypt, and beyond, that I think from an American perspective, the peace process does become more necessary. The problem is on the ground, it becomes less likely, and I think that Tom Pickering is right that the U.S. would be the only player who could break that dichotomy, but I think it's just politically so challenging for all of the reasons that Chaz said, and I think there is going to be a new initiative by the Obama administration. What exactly they're going to do to try to get around and out of the box. Basically, I think they've so undermined the Palestinian negotiators by this combination of getting pretty out in front on settlements and then coming back. I mean, I think it's really, to my mind, it's really the biggest error in U.S. foreign policy that's been taken by the administration. Either they should have said, this is going to be very, very hard to do politically, we have to do it. If we're going to do it, we're going to stay out there and defend it, or they shouldn't have done it at all. And I fear now that it will be very, very hard, I think particularly in the run-up to the election, to undertake the the kinds of political initiatives that this would take, very, very unlikely. Over the medium term here, Egypt may be a game changer in a positive direction. If indeed you have the Egyptian military remaining coherent and credible, you get a transition here to something that will certainly be more hostile to Israel, less friendly to the United States, but not a disaster. That might be the kind of a game changer that opens up the route for diplomacy. Unfortunately, I would be really surprised if this opening appeared before the 2012 presidential election.
Absolutely. Chaz, you have a
May I? Yes, I should say that while I agree we are the only country that could, as an individual actor, move or obstruct peace in the Israel-Palestine context, a single actor is not the only way that solutions can come about. Somebody asked, or several people asked, very good questions about the United Nations and its role. And in his remarks, Tom Pickering referred to what I would call, these are not his words, a future approach based on variable geometry internationally. Variable geometry for solving problems. That is, building ad hoc coalitions, either within the UN framework or outside it, that can address all of the problems that we now have seen so terribly neglected, global problems that others have talked about, issues of peace and war like this one. So I think there are possibilities. If the United States continues, as we did the other day, to make the United Nations impotent and irrelevant or even injurious to the prospect of peace, the possibility is that people will organize outside the United Nations and despite us impose their own views of what sort of peace there should be. And here I would note that resolution that we sponsored against 14 members of the Security Council, including our closest European allies, who spoke in favor of it quite forcefully, 14-1 vote in the Security Council, our veto, had 130 countries as sponsors. And this issue will move to the General Assembly in September. It's not over. And the United States is either on the train or we risk, like poor old Pauline, getting run over by it. And a final comment I would make is that it's not simply the world's loss of patience with us on this issue that is at issue, and I think the world and the region have lost patience with us on this issue. But there are things happening in the region that will alter Israeli calculuses. There has been no balance of power in the region since the Camp David Accords. Israel has had undisputed dominance, and that was the result of the Camp David Accords. That sustaining that has been the objective of our policy. But if, in fact, Egypt is more responsive to the popular will, if other countries also are more responsive to the popular will, then Israel will not be able to indulge itself in the sort of moral hazard it has. It will have to consider the risks of stiff-arming. It will have to consider the risks of seeking peace only through a drawn gun held against all its neighbors rather than through an agreement. And I think there are a lot of very smart and decent people in Israel, and a change in the strategic environment around that country that means that Israel again has to weigh risks could see a change in behavior and an opening that I think, on the basis of many, many conversations and much travel in the Arab world, would be seized with alacrity by Arab leaders.
Which basically means that the overthrow of Mubarak could, in fact, have a very positive effect.
It could.
It could. It could. Let's hope. All right, we go to, right? Yeah. What do students in China, Japan, and Vietnam learn about their respective histories? Does history instruction in these countries tend to foster regional understanding or nationalism? That's from Belfast.
Great question.
Who wants to start that?
Well, I'll share with you
personal experience. My mother is Japanese. My father is American. Because I had a good Confucian mother, I went to Japanese school on weekends. I went to English language schools on weekdays. And I studied about World War II in my Japanese textbooks and in my American textbooks. And there was a marked difference in the way that certain things were portrayed. I then studied in Nanjing, where, of course, the Nanking Massacre happened. And you will find very little about that in Japanese textbooks, and you will find an inordinate amount about that in Chinese textbooks. If you talk to Vietnamese young people, they will, contrary to the idea that China is not an expansionist power, they will remind you that Vietnam was in fact colonized by China for 1,000 years. So I think there are many different histories that have not necessarily been integrated within Asia.
We're going to do Lanjin first and then go to Jiaxin.
Yes, there has been a long-standing dispute about textbooks, as we all know. I mean, but you see, the situation is this. Because of the political history of both countries, I'm talking about Japan and China, the different trajectory of their history, there is a reason for example, for Japan to change their high school textbook, every couple of years you see this becoming an issue. But most Chinese, of course, they don't understand why Japanese even dare to do so. They don't understand the meaning of the Tokyo Tribunal, which they didn't. That tribunal, unlike the Nuremberg, that did not put the Emperor Hirohito on trial. So there is no sense of collective guilt. You know, the Japanese never think that war as being part of the collective, or the Germans, they bend backwards to apologize, sometimes even embarrassingly, about their deeds during that. But for China as well, because the communist history tried to eliminate other political factors who play also a very important role, like a KMT role and so on and so forth. So they try to, you know, make that history into a rather partial history. But that has been changing, because Chinese at least are debating very actively on whether we need to get rid of that kind of textbook writing. Or Japan still having some problem there, I think.
We've just been listening to selections from the final session of the 2011 Camden Conference, which featured a question and answer period in which most of the conference's presenters participated. Preceding these excerpts from the final Q&A session, we heard a presentation by Hannah Beach, Asia Bureau Chief for Time Magazine. If you missed any part of this program or would like to hear it again, you can listen online or download this program from WERU's Public Affairs Archives. Just go to www.weru.org, click on Public Affairs Archives on the station's homepage, then scroll down to Camden Conference. All of the programs in this 2011 Camden Conference series are available there. For more information about the Camden Conference itself, please go to www.camdenconference.org. Thanks for listening to this WERU special from the 2011 Camden Conference.